Chapter 1, take 2.
Nice.
Go on then, you cutie.
My investigation became more like an obsession. I would walk any trail if it meant finding a trace of one of the computers at its end. I was determined to prove their existence and their talent in a way that meant they would never again be lost to history. As the photos and memos and equations and family stories became real people, as the women became my companions and returned to youth or returned to life, I started to want something more for them than just putting them on the record. What I wanted was for them to have the grand, sweeping narrative that they deserved. The kind of American history that belongs to the Wright brothers and the astronauts, to Alexander Hamilton and Martin Luther King Jr. Not told as a separate history, but as a part of the story we all know. Not at the margins, but at the very center. The protagonists of the drama. And not just because they are black or because they are women, but because they are part of the American epic. Today, my hometown, the hamlet that in 1962 dubbed itself Spacetown, USA, looks like any suburban city in a modern and hyper-connected America. People of all races and nationalities mingle on the Hamptons beaches and in its bus stations, the whites-only signs of the past now relegated to the local history museum and the memories of the survivors of the Civil Rights Revolution. Mercury Boulevard no longer conjures images of the eponymous mission that shot the first Americans beyond the atmosphere, and each day the memory of Virgil Grissom fades away from the bridge that bears his name. A downsized space program and decades of government cutbacks have hit the region hard. Today, an ambitious college grad with a knack for numbers might set her sights on a gig at Silicon Valley startup, or make for one of the many technology firms that are conquering the NASDAQ from the Virginia suburbs outside of Washington, D.C. But before a computer became an inanimate object, and before Mission Control landed in Houston, before Sputnik changed the course of history, and before the NACA became NASA, before the Supreme Court case, Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, established that separate was in fact not equal, and before the poetry of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech rang out over the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Langley's West computers were helping America dominate aeronautics, space research, and computer technology, carving out a place for themselves as female mathematicians who were also black, black mathematicians who were also female. For a group of bright and ambitious African-American women, diligently prepared for a mathematical career and eager for a crack at the big leagues, Hampton, Virginia must have felt like the center of the universe.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Ko meri toku ingoa.
Ko briana toku ingoa.
Tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou katoa. Hello, welcome everyone to Chapter 1, Take 2, the podcast where we read the book, watch the film, and then discuss the adaptation. My name is Maddie.
My name is Brianna.
And this episode, we are covering the incredibly important Hidden Figures.
Equilateral, trapezoid, isosceles, tetrahedron.
I have never seen a mind like the one your daughter has. You have to see what she becomes.
Come on!
That's right.
That's right. Thank you for that reading. I'd ask why you read it, but I know why you read it.
Well, since you didn't ask, I picked that because specifically when we first started reading the book, I was reading this out loud to you, and I read that section and it made me choke up. But I also really liked the part where Margot Lee Shetterly, because this is actually from the prologue,
yes,
says, what I wanted for them was to have a grand sweeping narrative that they deserve, the kind of American history that belongs to the Wright brothers and the astronauts, to Alexander Hamilton, Martin Luther King Jr., not told as a separate history, but as part of the story we all know, not at the margins, but at the very center, the protagonists of the drama.
Mm.
And while these three women are technically at the center, technically the protagonists of Hidden Figures, the film, those three women being Catherine Coleman, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, I would argue that they aren't necessarily the center of every story, and they're not the center of their struggle.
They're not the center of this story?
Not in the movie.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that the two most important moves forward that we see with the bathrooms and then Catherine Coleman / Catherine Goble / Catherine Johnson being let into the mission control room for the launch happened because a white person allows it to happen.
Right.
But not only do those two things not happen at all like that in the book, or even kind of remotely like that in the book, the book makes it very clear that, yes, white people, black people needed white allies to make steps forward, but also a lot of the steps that they made happened because it was time.
Well, you get to a point where progress has to happen. Like, it's the same way with women getting the quotations right to vote. Like, men had to decide to give women legally the right to vote.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in that way, like, we need allies. But, like, in terms of, you know, the bathroom situation in the book, I know we're jumping right into this, but in the book, Catherine Johnson just never uses colored bathrooms. And
yeah.
It's never brought up.
Yeah.
It's not a thing because it's like they need Catherine Johnson to be there.
Yeah. Well, the one time that a complaint was raised that she was using a supposedly white's bathroom that wasn't labeled, she ignored the complaint and it was never brought up again.
Yeah, because what are they going to do?
Exactly. She's legally has the right to work there. I want to know, because that bit, you know, when did Hamilton, the musical, come out?
My brain says 2016.
Because it talks about that in the opening.
It talks about Alexander Hamilton. So its first production was in 2013.
Oh, wow.
And its first Broadway production was in 2015.
I did not realize it had been out that long.
Well, the thing is about Broadway is that a lot of the times you have an off-Broadway production before you get to the Broadway stage, you've got to work your way up. So we don't hear about it until it gets to Broadway, usually. Because we don't run in those circles.
Yeah. Second question. You talking about getting choked up at the beginning of that. How do books like this, because this book is non-fiction, whereas the movie is more of a
dramatization.
Yeah. I think something described it as a fiction and fiction documentary.
Yeah.
Or something. How does that make you feel as an American considering, the current world that we live in and you being in Aotearoa?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking.
I don't really know what I'm asking either. I guess it's kind of a dumb question because obviously some things will make you proud to be from America and some things will make you not proud. I guess, how connected do you feel to this story?
I think what I'm proud of is how incredible marginalized people, and I'm not just including Black Americans, I'm also including gay Americans, and not even just Americans, how incredible their resilience is. You know, some of the lines from the film the film is well written. Like, it's very powerful. It's very Oscar baity.
It is very Oscar baity.
The film, what I really, you know, some of the lines that I enjoyed about it were like when Catherine said, nobody dreamed about going into space until we did it.
Yes.
And now we've done it.
Yeah.
You know, somebody always has to, you know, and Mary Jackson's speech, like, somebody's got to be the first.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically marginalized people are always like, well, I'm going to be the first.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And I respect that. And I think that I really enjoy, because there's a fine line between being like, sure that you're on the right side of history, being like, I'm going to be the first, I'm going to push my case. Like, being a black woman and wanting to be the first engineer, as a black woman, the first engineer, wanting to be the first female black engineer at NASA is obviously on the right side of history, but some people are so confident that staying the course and keeping status quo is the right side of history. Because you and I have some conversations where I try and tell you not to follow the rules, but you really like sticking to the rules because you've been told that that's how you reach success. But then you see people like this breaking the rules because they have to and they should, and the rules are wrong. And so I find it interesting with your hesitation at breaking rules, even though you know things like this.
Well, they're very ingrained in me.
Yeah.
And in certain ways, I did receive a lot of success in following the rules. The problem with me continuing to follow the rules is that it was always such an exertion to try and do it.
Yeah.
To be that person. And I realized somewhere along the road, and I'm still always realizing, that it shouldn't be an exertion to be yourself.
No.
And we're coming, I think we're always moving toward a world where it is less and less of an exertion to be yourself.
Definitely. And it is very vulnerable to be yourself as well. Like that is a very hard thing to do, and we're not told to do that in society. So I totally understand that.
But I think it's interesting because, you know, we're talking about this, and you know, I'm kind of alluding to homosexuality, but also to not conforming to all of the rules of gender, like being a bossy girl and stuff like that. Those are things that I can hide. I shouldn't have to, but they are things that I can hide, and the color of your skin is not one of them. And that's what makes race so different.
Totally. I was even thinking even more specific, like in work environments, how you don't say things even though you feel like you should. Like, not even extreme things, but just, you know, someone says something and you don't argue with them because of the context. And it's awkward, and people, you know, some people just avoid awkwardness. Anyway, getting back to the book. Hidden Figures was published by Margaret Lee...
Written by. Publishing and writing are different things.
They are different things. Hidden Figures was written by Margot Lee Shetterly.
Yes.
And published in September 2016, but the rights had already been bought in 2014, and she had started working on the book in 2010. And then in January 2017, the film was released in Canada. So it was a very fast timeline.
And this was her first book.
It's her first book.
And the quality of the writing is...
She did an excellent job. She originally was in investment banking and then moved more into the media industry. So, like, I find that very interesting. But I think for me, what I really enjoy about reading stuff like that, when it's someone's first book... I feel like this episode is just me attacking you, but I find it so interesting to challenge your views on things, right? Because I'm very much of the belief that you and I are like special in the way that we see the world, because everyone is, but also I feel like you and I have some really interesting things to say, and not everyone wants to be in the spotlight. Not everyone wants to share, you know, some people just want to be left alone. But I say things about like us publishing a book, and your immediate thing is to be like, yeah, but people, just because you get published doesn't mean it will sell well, and just because, you know, all those things, there's all those steps in the way. But then people, and obviously this Hidden Figures was a very important book, and it's disgusting that we didn't already know all these stories, specifically about these three women, but also I'm sure there's, just throughout all history, there are people who should have been credited but have not been. Right, but I love using things like this as an example to you that, like, yeah, sure, the chances are low, but you could be that success, you know? Like I feel like you still do a lot, but it's almost like you talk yourself out of success before you even get there.
No, that's fair.
And I just find it so interesting.
Welcome to our therapy podcast.
Analyzing your own self-doubts. I'll go through my facts. The film was critically and fiscally a great success. Well, it was. It does. It was done really well. The film's over 2 hours long, and it absolutely needs to be. Like, if you're watching the film and you enjoy it, you should absolutely read the book, because you get so, like, the book is over, what, 4 decades?
Mm.
If not a bit longer.
It's three. I would say 3 decades.
Yeah,
it's wild.
But the
3 to 4. Yeah.
The movie is just like
one.
1 year.
1 decade.
1 decade.
Maybe 2.
It's not 2 decades. Oh, we see Catherine as a child, but then we only see her as an adult. Brie's gonna sneeze.
No. I can't remember exactly what year the film starts in, but I think it starts in the 1950s and ends in the 1960s.
Yes, I think you're right. 7.8 on.
But it doesn't get to the moon landing, so. And I know the moon landing was in 1969.
We went to the moon in 1969.
Not 1970, the year before.
Yeah. 7.8 on IMDb, 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. Directed by Theodore Melfi, who...
Don't have a lot of good things to say about him.
No?
No.
Mm. He's just... Is he a white guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And he also... It was co-written and produced with a white woman, Alison Schroeder.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think that's interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, yes.
Nothing like a white person to tell a black person's story.
Theodore also did St. Vincent in 2014, which has Bill Murray in it. I haven't seen it, but I saw the trailer for it and I was like, meh. The budget for the film was $25 million. Would you like to guess at how much the film made worldwide?
$1.2 billion.
Oh, no, not that successful.
$75 million.
Don't be silly. It's not Marvel or Avatar, blue people, not Airbender. $236 million.
Amazing.
So still really good, but nowhere near a billion, unfortunately. Yeah.
It's fine. Really.
The stars are Taraji P. Henson, played Katherine Johnson.
/ Katherine Grubble, / Katherine Coleman.
Yes. Octavia Spencer played Dorothy Vaughan. Janelle Monáe played Mary Jackson, who did an absolutely delightful... Like, she was just so much fun to watch in that role. I loved it. Kevin Costner played Al Harrison. Jim Parsons played Paul Stafford, and Kirsten Dunst played Vivian Mitchell. Those two characters weren't based on real people, but more of a combination of people and hurdles that the three main actresses had to overcome.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's all that I got. I quite enjoyed. Yes?
I don't know if Al Henson was a real person either. But I'm not sure. Can't remember. There were a lot of people in the book.
Yeah, well, there's lots of people involved with NASA.
Yeah.
Which actually...
It's like a lot of people.
What does it stand for again?
National Aeronautics and Space
Administration.
Administration.
Yeah. Continue with your thoughts and feelings.
I was just saying there's a lot of people.
Yeah, there is a lot of people. But yeah, those are my facts. I'm glad it made so much money. It won some Oscars. I really love that they had the 98-year-old Katherine Johnson on stage at the 2017 Oscars. They gave her a mic and she just said, like, thank you very much. And this, you know, because she's an old woman. And she's dead now.
She is. Okay, let's talk about how do you rate the film as an adaptation of the book?
Like an 8.
Hmm.
And I say that, like,
4.
Yeah. But for me, it's really hard because I don't have... Like, I can't remember heaps of the book because there's no placement for me. There's no holder. She gives a bunch of dates and I loved it. I loved the book. Like, hearing about all of the protests that happen and the way that they... What's it called when things, as they roll, they gather more mass? snowball effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what snowballs do. I loved reading about that and, like, the progression of African-American rights throughout America. And I loved the parallels, because it's nothing that I'd ever considered as a white bitch. The parallels of asking black people or anyone who's not white to go to war for you or to work for you and have them fight a foreign enemy but not give them equal rights on home soil.
It was particularly bad in World War II because they were fighting for the liberation of Jewish people.
Yeah.
Whilst being oppressed at home.
Yeah. And I love that. And I found that so, like, I love listening to the book. But there was just such a range, an expanse amount of knowledge and data and dates and facts that I don't have. For me, I remember emotions. Like, that's why I can quote movies and mainly animations, because they're like bright colors, images, emotional, like tear jerky or laughter, you know. But I can't remember a lot of the book because to me, there's no grounding.
I see. I understand what you're saying. Like, there's a struggle between commercialization.
Yes.
And because they could have made a docuseries. And
yes.
That would have been cool as well. But it wouldn't have reached as many people as Hidden Figures did.
No. And exactly. You've got to make that call, which is more important. Like, getting all the facts out there, getting all the, like, but if people don't find it entertaining, they're just not going to remember it or be interested.
But the thing is that frustrates me is I hope that we get another film out of this.
Yeah, we could get individual. We could get individual films
for the end of thing. But like, yeah, I hope we see another film out of Hidden Figures. But I'm not sure that we will, because I'm not sure if we'll get there. But we don't know what we could have had if a black person had directed and written a script.
Mm.
We don't know what story we would have gotten.
100%.
And I don't doubt that there still would have been some commercialization to make it more accessible.
Mm.
But I think that what they plucked out from the story would have been different. Because it's clear to me that, what was the director's name? Fuckface?
Theodore?
Yeah, Fuckface. The thing is that, like, for him, he clearly wanted to make an Oscar-worthy film where he highlighted racism and gave, you know, a white person that white people in the audience could look at and be like, I'd be that person. I'd be that person 60 years ago. when in reality, we're probably... by that person, I mean Kevin Costner and knocking down the bathroom sign and letting... letting Katherine Johnson into Mission Control. We want, you know, we all want to be Kevin Costner, but we're not. We're probably more Kirsten Dunst. Like, the best of us are probably Kirsten Dunst.
Yep.
We're, like, slightly indifferent because we've got our own problems in our lives, which is, I think we don't see any of Kirsten Dunst's character's problems, but she probably has them. She's a white woman. She's still a woman working at NASA. She's still dealing with sexism in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But
she's from Brooklyn, in case you were curious.
When she's going to work hard to be an ally, and she's got to really try to understand their perspective, and that's maybe what the best of us would have been.
Yeah. I gotta tell you,
even, and those people didn't exist.
Even being in the rainbow community and wanting to think of how people would stand up for me when I wasn't in the room, I still find it hard to speak my truth and correct people when I know that I'm right. So, like, we were at a play and a friend of ours was misgendering a performer, and it took him doing it 3 times... for me to finally and I thought about it each time, and I noticed each time, and on the third time I corrected him because I wanted to do it in a way that didn't make my friend feel attacked, because I wanted him to take what I said on board and actually apply it, but I wanted him to feel like it's okay that he makes mistakes, but he needs to correct when he is given the information. And this is all the thought process that I went through for correcting my friend about something very minor that he didn't mean to do, let alone confronting someone who is being obviously and intentionally racist or homophobic. So it's like, yeah, we would all like to think that we would be that white person, but unless you're in that position of power that Al was, which is like the straight white cis man boss, you don't have the confidence or the power to say something. And that's
a lot of the time.
And that's why I get so frustrated when managers are like, well, what are you doing to help correct this problem? Especially when there's a power imbalance. And it's like, nah, bitch. Like, I'm telling you about it because I need you to support me, because you have to acknowledge that I'm at the bottom of the food chain and you have to help. And so it's like, yeah, we all like to think that we would be fighting racism, but at the end of the day, especially if you're just a white person, you've got your own stuff to worry about, and like, you're probably just going about your daily life. Yeah. Sorry, that's my little rant.
No. I totally agree with you. And the thing is that, like, you're right. Anybody who's in a marginalized position needs people who are in the non-marginalized position to support them and ally for them.
Yeah.
In the privileged position. And the problem is that Kevin Costner's character doesn't support Dorothy or Catherine Coleman's revolutionary ideas, which weren't that revolutionary. Like, they were, but they weren't. You know, it's basic human decency.
Mm.
He does it for her. And I sent you an article. We're going to link it in the description. It's a beautiful article about the film, and it talks about the two white savior moments when Kevin Costner's character knocks down the sign and then lets Katherine Johnson / Katherine Goebel / Katherine Coleman.
Do you want to just say Katherine?
Yeah, Katherine. Into the mission control room. And neither of those events happened in the story, so they didn't necessarily need to be included, but they're real dramatic. And so if we're going for commercialization, you want to include that, like, narrative.
Mm.
What should have happened is, you know, we talked about a version where Katherine just goes into the bathroom and, you know, it's like a personal triumph and it's quiet. And that still could have been done really well, because all of the actresses in this film are stunning enough to be able to do that.
Totally.
The one that in the article suggests is that Catherine's just the one who knocks down the sign because she's got the rage to do it.
Mm.
There's no way a white guy is going to knock down that sign. He's going to call someone to do it.
Yeah.
He's going to call someone. It's going to be very non-eventful.
Absolutely.
But Catherine is angry enough. And so instead of having her do that big speech in the film,
mm-hmm.
Just have her knock down the sign and then have him not fire her.
Yeah.
And then the same thing with Mission Control. Instead of having him let her in, she should have snuck in and he should have just been like, you know, turn, like, what I did was like turn and nod at her. And it just not be a thing. Like, yeah. that's the level of allyship.
But that's also more realistic, because a lot of the time progress happens when someone in the marginalized group takes a risk and someone in the power group lets it happen.
Yeah, or supports it.
Yeah, or supports it. A lot of the time it isn't the group in dominance making those changes. But
it's not a lot of the time. It's all of the time. All of the time. Even in the situation with, like, suffragettes, where you're talking about before, like, yeah, white people gave men gave women the right, white women the right to vote, and then a long time later, black people the right to vote. Yes. They did that, but they didn't do that of their own accord. They did that because of the whites,
exactly.
The female suffragettes who fought that battle.
You're 100% right. But we're always telling the story from the dominant group perspective to give them the pat on the back, being like, hey, we did the thing.
Yeah, because white people need someone to empathize with, to go like, I would be that person.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, imagine that film where Kevin Costner is just sort of indifferent, more like Kirsten Dunst's character.
Yes, and it wouldn't have been as successful. And would that, like, I guess, is it dangerous that we keep repeating this inaccurate narrative that isn't from real life? Or is it a sacrifice we have to make to get the stories out there because we're not there yet as society, you know?
I don't think that we're not there yet, though.
Yeah? That's what I'm asking you.
I think that, like, you know, we... The Color Purple isn't perfect, but it doesn't have a white savior narrative in it.
No. It was also done in the 1960s.
And the white... Yeah, and the white savior narrative that it does have is... It's parodying the white savior narrative in a lot of ways.
Mm.
So, we've seen it done, and we've seen it done successfully, and there are other films that are incredible that don't have a white savior narrative in them.
Totally. I think
so.
Yeah, I think a lot of the failures of film and television that are trying to be educational, when they just come across preachy and they lose the message because they're telling the audience rather than just showing them. Like your two examples was just showing someone the progress and the rebellion needed by people of color. But it's the same thing that's kind of what happened with the female Doctor Who. Like instead of just letting her be awesome and be the doctor and write good episodes, they made her a preachy bitch who talks about being upgraded because now she's a woman. And it's like, you could have done that so that you didn't alienate a whole gender.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And I think it's such a weird missed opportunity considering that you can have such high quality writers, but they, you know, you don't, if someone is a woman playing a role that was traditionally played by a man, she will succeed in the role by doing it well, not by rubbing it in everyone's face that she is a woman.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Hopefully, it paves the way for more female doctors, though.
Absolutely.
And harkens back to a new era. But
well, obviously, where I hope that it would get to would it be more of a commentary on gender and non-binary in general.
Yeah.
Like, I just think that, you know, and I'm quite a radical, progressive person. Radical. I'm radical in the sense that I literally want everyone to be able to do what they want as long as it's not harming other people or the planet. Radical! Everyone should have a universal basic income. I just think we are getting to more of a point where, and maybe it's just the circles that I'm in, but we're talking more and more about breaking down the divide between genders and how the gender construct is a construct.
Yeah. Coming back to the book.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. It's great combo. Great little sidetrack there. I felt like, to me, the book was saying, like, a few things. Number one, that it's kind of like racism is and is not the center of these women's lives.
Yes, absolutely.
It's both.
Yeah. I love the bit where she describes the weight that is always on the shoulders of them. And they, like, sometimes the mask falls when they show how drained they really are. And that's when they lose their patience. I thought that was described so well for someone that this is their first book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I love, but I also love, like, that they also have so many other things
yeah.
going on in their lives that yeah. they have to worry about.
Yeah.
Just like everyone.
Yeah.
And I feel like they, you know, the book says a lot of the time that NASA and NACA, which NACA isn't featured really, or the NACA nuts, which I feel like said 50 million times in the book. So I don't know how it didn't end up in the film.
You probably didn't read it.
It isn't talked about. Like the film, I felt like was so much more about racism and like their daily struggle, but I felt like the book was about their successes.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't about what was standing in their way. It's about how they overcame it.
Yeah.
But
that's the difference, I think, with books and film in general, is that books are like the hard-earned wins over long periods of time, and movies are about like those short, sharp things.
I still feel like that. Like I don't want to cut the movie any slack.
Okay.
I think it could have been better. I think we deserved better. I think those women deserved better. I think if you read the opening of this book and you still wrote that film, you missed the point.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's why I wanted to read it. Like, I think you missed the point. They deserve to be part of history. The movie that they made is a film about racism. This book is about three incredible yes. women.
Yes.
And how they are part of our story.
Totally.
And not just part, central to it.
Absolutely.
I think that's what Black Americans are always trying to get white Americans to understand, and why things like Black History Month are problematic solutions to a long-term issue. It's, you know, they shouldn't be relocated to one month. They shouldn't get their own History Month. They should be at the center of history all throughout the year because they were there.
Yeah.
They should be told as part of every narrative because they were there. Because every success in America included black people.
Well, it was built off their backs.
Yeah. And even though, like, they made Catherine's calculations seem much more integral to the success of the launch than they were. I mean, she was part of a team. Like, I feel like her story is much more incredible. It's like, there's something really poetic about the fact that Catherine was just so smart and so talented that when she got into the room, she got along with the men because she belonged there.
Mm.
And it's just like, yeah, of course she did. Because black women who can do the job, and they exist, deserve a spot at the table.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Really interesting. And I am now, sorry, there's something in my mouth. I can't get. By something, I mean my nail that I bit myself, so it's my fault. So there, I've been, I found Red Table Talk on Facebook, and I've been really enjoying it because it is, a different narrative than what I get to experience, because, like, over 90% of our friends are white, and so we don't talk about race as much as we should, and I've been reminded of the, reality of the invisible black woman, and I feel like what you were just describing was that, because I didn't know what you were upset about, and now I understand. It's like, you're absolutely right. Instead of making a Broadway production about Alexander Hamilton, instead of making a movie about Katherine Johnson and everyone, they were like, hey, racism's bad. And, like, yeah, I agree with you. Like, we haven't made their names. We haven't made the names of Catherine, Dorothy, and Mary household names.
Yeah. I feel like the story they told was a story that has already been told. And it's been being told again and again and again. And it's a story of how hard it is to be black in America. And it is hard. And it was hard. But this isn't that story. And I don't think that's what Margot Lee Shetterly was trying to tell. Like, she was definitely talking about racism and how it was interjected, but to me, she was talking about these three brilliant women who made huge strides, often by asking for it, often by just taking it, always with their own initiative, always with their own belief, often they felt quite alone, but like, you know, there's a character called Catherine Mann, she's a real person, character in the book that's not included in the film because she was so much younger than three leads, and I understand why she got cut out. But if these three women had not been there, Catherine Mann's job would have been so much harder because, you know, we talked about, you know, and Mary Jackson talks about being the first. It's so important to be the first, but it's also so important to be the second, you know, and these women, and they talk about that in the book, these women wouldn't have been there. Dorothy Vaughan, Katherine Johnson, and Mary Jackson would not have been there if it had not been for the white women who came before them.
That's right.
You know, and it's so much about that, like how they helped each other and how every success that a black woman made was also a success for a white woman, and how they were connected by their gender and separated by their race. And
no, I agree. I,
you know, like it's so much more than that. It's not just about racism. It's about breaking the glass ceiling.
Yeah,
and how some people crack it first.
Absolutely, because I found something that Margot wrote in here about once a barrier is broken, it doesn't need to be broken again. And I disagreed with that. Like, she was talking about breaking the sound barrier or something and using it as an analogy on race. And for me, talking from the rainbow experience, you don't get to come out once. You come out daily, if not anytime you meet a new person. Like, you, and obviously it's different because you can hide your sexuality if you want to, but like, I don't know that I don't agree with the fact that once a barrier is broken, it doesn't need to be broken again. Like, I think it needs to, like you were just saying, it is also important to be the second, because it's like, if you take your foot off the gas, you'll lose momentum, and it's really easy for people who are still in the dominant group to want to take some of that power back.
Well, I see what you're saying, but I also think, you know, it's never as hard the second time because you've already seen that someone can do it. And I think that's the point.
Mm.
There's already a hole. You might make the hole bigger, but there's already a hole.
Yeah. But you're kind of arguing for your own point then as well, because it's like you're both talking about the narrative of like slow progress over time achieved by the many, but you're also wanting to single out these women and tell their stories.
But I mean, she tells so many stories.
Yeah, she does.
In this book. And she even talks about how in the epilogue, she talks, Margot Lee Shetterly talks about how there were other stories, there was so much.
Mm.
And like every time she would unlock another piece of the puzzle, she was like, oh, I could talk about this. And she had to condense it and figure out a narrative for the book. And I think the narrative works.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can't tell the story of every white person or every black person. These three black women, there's more like five or six in the book, were incredibly exceptional and incredibly essential. Oh,
yes. We talked about this. Yeah. I brought it up with you. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that's why when I talk about this with you sometimes, how I have no interest really in seeing any more movies where the main character is a attractive cis white straight man. Because I'm like, if we never told that story again and only filled the content with every other demographic, it would take so long to equal out the amount of content we have. Like, to reach equilibrium would take the rest of my life.
Mm.
And that's why a lot of the time with movies, when I just see a male white lead, I'm like, but why though?
I feel like there are still stories worthy of telling about straight white men.
Straight white men.
I feel like there are still stories worth telling about straight white men, because I don't think that straight white men are happy with the mold that they're supposed to fit into.
Sure.
You know, like the song that we heard tonight, and I don't want to give away too many details because it's not our song to tell about, and it hasn't been fully released. But the song we heard tonight was about, you know, how to be a man.
How to be a man.
And it was a parody. It was wonderful. And those songs are still coming out, and they still resonate with us because men still feel those pressures.
Yeah, but I would say...
And so I think we do need stories about straight white men breaking that mold more frequently.
Definitely.
But, I agree.
Yeah.
They probably only need to be like 10%.
I'm just getting to the point where it's like we are trying to hold their hands so much. Like, they just need to catch the fuck up. Is where I'm at. Like, and I'm, you know, maybe just an angry gay, but it's like, just move over for a bit, you know? Mm. And it's frustrating because a lot of the pain, like, in the world is caused by straight white men.
I totally get what you're saying. I feel like, you know, in Inside by Bo Burnham was kind of asking that question, like, as a straight white male, where do I fit?
Mm.
He's an artist, and he creates incredible work, but he also knows that he's taking up space.
Yeah, he is.
And you don't want artists like Bo Burnham to go away.
No, but it's kind of what Deborah Francis White said about the Monty Python group. Like, while they've added great content to the comedic world and art, what would be taking their place if there was that space for them?
Hmm. I totally understand. It's very complicated because...
It's so complicated!
There are probably lots of intersectionally diverse people who are just as talented as Bo Burnham but haven't got his acclaim because they're intersectionally diverse.
Yeah.
And he... It doesn't mean that he's not also talented enough to have the acclaim that he has, because he is.
Totally.
But it was easier for him because he's white, male, and handsome.
Yeah. I think, why was I thinking about this the other day? But it was like, your success is so much more based on where you're born, what you look like, what your gender is, than anything to do with your talent or your ability. Like, luck has much bigger part to play. Like, sure, you could work your butt off and maybe get there, but it was depending on some other factors completely out of your control will completely debate whether or not it works.
I think it's both. Like, I think that there are some aspects of our society that aren't meritocratic. But I don't think it is ever that straightforward.
That's fine.
So, I mean, I agree with you. But, I mean, we know that there are some aspects that are meritocratic because we do see marginalized people rise to the top.
True.
It's
harder to cover... But
there is a lot of luck with it, is what I would agree. And luck is something different than privilege. There is quite, I think, you know, being in the right place and the right frame of mind at the right time with the right resources can make a huge difference.
Absolutely. I feel like episodes like this are such a different vibe from when we cover books that are trash.
It's hard because we're white people and we're talking about a black book, and there are probably black people who've made better, more interesting podcast episodes about this book and about other books and about other stories about this. And my best hope for this is that this is a nice transition podcast for well-meaning white people to learn a bit more and to expand their horizons.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like honestly the best that I can hope for. We're taking up space. I wonder all the time in this podcast, you know, we decided to do a season of strong female-led characters. This is a strong female-led character. Interesting how many strong female-led character books have been memoirs or, like, nonfiction. I think that's fascinating. I think that says something, but I'm not quite sure what it says.
Do you mean like women are telling their own stories rather than having stories told about them?
Yeah, like,
something
like that.
For sure.
But I wonder if, you know, we decided that 50% had to feature people of color.
Or members of the Rainbow community.
Or members of the Rainbow computer community, ideally.
Computer!
Computer. Ideally a bit of both. But, and we've held to that.
We have.
But is that enough to justify us taking up space?
Well, we were just talking about how important allyship and exposure is in this sense.
Yeah, but I think that's a dangerous line for white allies to take. Like, we are not far off the pecking order, like, in terms of being near the top.
I mean, I disagree with that. I think we're women, we're members of the Rainbow community, we both struggle with mental health. I think as far as white privilege goes, we've got it in spades, and that's massive. Like, that's one of the...
But we're also thin and able-bodied and attractive.
Are we attractive? No, I know.
Well, I am.
No. I agree with you, honey. I guess I feel...
We're middle class. I guess we're probably upper middle class.
And my defensiveness probably comes from me wanting to, I feel defensive about my own struggles. But I've been going through a lot. Like, more mental health than I've ever struggled with. But
You're defensive about your own struggles?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what straight white men are as well.
I understand. But I have no patience for them.
I'm just saying, it's a bit of a double standard thing.
Oh, I am a hypocrite. Like, I have no, you know... I'm working on myself as fast as I can, but also at the end of the day, I'm not walking out here pretending like I don't have flaws. And I think I am in many, many ways hypocritical. Like, I give you advice all the time that I don't follow myself. But I had something to say. Oh, it was, I understand what you're saying about, you know, us as white people talking about this, Hidden Figures. But I think with it, we're keeping it personal and local. So we're talking about our experiences and like how, you know, it's, we're not trying to speak on behalf of African Americans or members of the Black community. We're saying for us, like, this is what I have experienced and what I hope for. And because you were just talking about how you wished the film hadn't been directed by a white person, and I think it's great for a white person to say that, and that is allyship.
I agree. I think it would be better if a Black person could say it and then we just listen to them.
I agree, but I don't think we're there as society. And that's why we have things that are like, men still need to believe the woman in their lives when they tell them about how frequent and common sexual assault and sexual harassment is, because women are still not believed, even post the Me Too movement.
I don't feel like we're post yet. I feel like we're still during.
Well, it's still, exactly. Yeah. I, you know, I only agree with you, but that's what I'm saying.
Post Me Too initiation.
And, you know, fuck me if I'm totally wrong and like white people need to shut the fuck up about anything to do, like, and but I agree with you, you know, we should, any group, any marginalized group, if they say something, if they tell you it's a problem, if they try to correct you, just believe them. I wish we lived in that world, but we don't.
I think that, I guess my point is that as allies to the non-white community, I think that we always have to be critical of what we're doing. And I think that we need to make sure that we analyze the contributions we're making and whether or not they would be better made by someone else.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I worry in a very selfish way that we've already moved past our time in public settings, and we should already be getting to more progressive places. We should already be, you know, people who are not necessarily able-bodied in the same way, people who are people of color. Like, we should already be at their stories. And so for us to just be finding our performer and comedic voices and doing these shows to the public, I'm like, am I just holding back progress? Has my story already been told?
I don't think that our story has already been entirely told. Like, you know, we just watched Schitt's Creek and
a bit behind. When did it finish? Like 2015. Loved it.
So good. But we just watched Schitt's Creek and, you know, both of us remarked on how rare it is to see an entire gay relationship from beginning to end positive without, like, huge trauma being associated with it.
100%. No, you're totally right.
Like, I understood what they did with Patrick's coming out story, but I would have been fine if that didn't exist.
Yep.
You know, and we deserve to see more of those.
We did.
We also, as much as we deserve that, you're right. Like, we should be seeing more intersectional roles. Like, fuck, do we need more roles of disabled characters, disabled played by actors of that community.
Yeah, because we loved Schitt's Creek, but it was a super white show.
Yeah.
Like, there was maybe two or three named speaking characters who were people of color. Like, yes, it was good for the rainbow community. Were there? Oh yeah, Ronnie, they do that a lot. They double fist it, where Ronnie was both a woman of color and also a lesbian.
Yeah, just tick those boxes.
Yeah, just tick those fucking boxes. Because David was pansexual, which is cool. It's more than just being gay, but still a gay white man is still pretty, like, that story is one of the most common of the rainbow community. Like, where is the mainstream transgender person of color story? Where is it? You know? I didn't mean for this episode to be so dark and sad, but it's kind of appropriate considering the conversation that we had.
I feel like we're talking a lot about LGBTQA issues, and we should be talking more about Black issues. Like, I feel like we're taking up too much of the narrative with ourselves.
No, I agree with that. But I guess for me, I can't help but draw the parallels between... Because you're right. Like, and I don't want to speak to, because I'm white, but all I can speak to is the struggles I've been through being non-binary. But totally, Hidden Figures, people of color, it's a hard time, I'm sure.
Yeah, I do hope that we get another film out of this. As a film, just talking to some of the merits of the film, the costuming are beautiful. I love them.
It was a really pretty film.
It's a real pretty film.
Like, it was shiny and clean. I think we noticed, was there a shot out of focus? Was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one shot out of focus that I thought was weird, but no, I thought it was great, and I loved the interspersed, like, old footage of when real events happened. Yes, I love it when stuff like that happens. Like,
I mean, it was witty. It was very saucy. There were some great humorous moments.
Mm. The acting was amazing.
In spite of the fact that I really hate Kevin Costner tearing down the sign, I love how much he struggled with it. Like, yeah. It was a real struggle.
It took a while. I was thinking about that. I was like, how much had someone loosened this, and is he just doing it badly?
Yeah. And even though I think it's cheesy, we all pee the same color at NASA. It's a pretty funny line as well.
Pretty funny line indeed. All right. And rate the movie then in and of itself. Brianna, not.
Oh, it's so watchable.
It's so watchable.
Ethically, I'm opposed to it, but it's so watchable. Like, I've definitely been raised to enjoy the white savior narrative aspect of it.
Of course you have.
But I...
The hero's journey.
I'm gonna knock it down to a 5.
Wow. Is that you just wanting to be critical, though? Like, are you... Because you just said it's very watchable.
I think The Help is watchable, but I also think it's garbage.
I can't... But that's a very interesting comparison, because I have no desire to re-watch The Help, because it is too problematic. But I will re-watch this because it is less problematic.
What a low bar.
Yes. Oh. This is what we're working with. But like in The Help, Emma Stone is the main character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are so many other reasons why The Help is problematic.
Oh, totally. But I'm just...
Burn the book!
Yeah.
Burn the book!
Yes.
I rarely advocate for burning books, but let's burn it.
Yeah. Whereas Hidden Figures, at least the main three characters who have the most screen time and the most lines are women of colour.
Yep. Still a low bar, I say.
You're correct. It is a low bar. I would say...
I would love to see this film without a white savior narrative. That would make it at least 50% better.
Mm, yeah, I mean, I would give the film, like, a 6 or a 7. Like, I just really enjoy it, and I, But all of your criticisms are valid, but I would watch it again, even with those criticisms.
I would watch it again... I will raise mine to a 6.
You can keep it as a 5. I'm not saying you're wrong.
No. I'll raise it to a 6 because I would watch it again. But if another film came out that was directed and written by a black person and also didn't contain a white savior narrative about this, I would never see that film again. That's why I'm struggling to give it a higher rating.
No, totally. I
even if the overall quality of the film was slightly... like, less superior, but I just can't imagine that happening.
Yeah, because we talked about this,
We talk about this all the time, because people who are marginalized gotta be the beast of the beast of the beast.
Well, that's exactly, you know, right, isn't it?
Catherine's a fucking genius.
Yeah, she is a fucking genius.
She's constantly one of the smartest people in the
room. She finished university, she graduated university at 18 years old. I started when I was 20.
She's gotta be a genius to get her foot in the door.
Yeah.
So I just feel like...
Because you said before about how when she was in the room, like, she just got on with the guys and they respected her because she deserved to be there and she was supposed to be there. But...
They didn't see her race. They didn't see her gender.
Yeah.
They saw her brain.
Do you
and
think...
And a brain is raceless and genderless. I don't know if that's true. Don't quote me on that.
Do you think we've gone backwards a bit, though? Because, like, going back to... Red Table Talk, there was a doctor of a science, I can't remember what, but she told a story on her first day at the job, going to the mail room, and a white woman headed to the mail room as well, and they kind of made eye contact, and the black woman waved and the white woman didn't respond, and then the white woman got to the door first and scanned her card and was then followed in by the black woman who was getting her mail, and the white woman turned around and was like, "What are you doing here?" And she's like, "I'm getting my mail." And she's like, "Are you sure you're not getting it for someone else?" Like, she said that to her. And she's like, no, I'm here to get mail. I'm on my first day. And the white woman's like, "Where's your ID?" And she showed her ID. The black woman used it on the printer to show that it was a real ID. And the white woman still wouldn't believe her. And then a receptionist, another white woman, came in and confirmed with the first white woman that she did in fact work there. And then the receptionist asked the black woman, "Why didn't you just tell her that you worked here?" And it's like, she fucking did. But it wasn't until another white woman confirmed it. Like, and that, like, I get what you're saying about Catherine being smart enough to be in the room and the men disrespecting her. But I sometimes also feel like we've gone backwards, where I'm not sure if we're all more, like, white people are more paranoid now or what. But, like, that black scientist woman had an ID and was still not being taken seriously.
What a great subject. Let me just get another book down, because you know how I am about books.
Yeah.
Let me do it without crashing all of the books off the shelf onto the computer. Okay, so this book is called White Rage. It's by Carol Anderson. And it talks about how every time black people made any progress in getting rights, white people tried to claw it back. And that's a fact.
Yeah.
One of the other books that I read, which is called Lies My Teacher Told Me, another really great book, explains some of the same truths in this. And one of the ones that stuck out to me is the most is like Jackie Robinson, is widely considered to be the first black American baseball player,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't.
No.
He's maybe the one who made it popular, but before the turn of the century, black people actually afforded more rights and more, were afforded more rights and more equality. And then as the Reconstruction period ended and there was a change over the power in the presidency, white people clawed that shit back.
Yeah.
And it got worse. And Jim Crow came later, and the Ku Klux Klan came later.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying to you about,
Margot. Sorry, that book is by, James W. Lowen.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying to you about, like, the glass ceiling doesn't get broken once. The barrier doesn't get broken once. Like, it's a battle forever.
I see what you're saying.
I'm not saying don't fight it.
I think that we might be saying the glass ceiling represents different things. I feel like we're agreeing and disagreeing at the same time. I feel like we're using
all of our arguments.
It's like it's a
you and I agree.
It's a language thing.
It's a language barrier.
I don't think we're worse off, but I think that there are pockets where things are worse. There are pockets where progress hasn't yet really sunken in. And that could be, in that pocket could be a person, it could be a family, it could be a city, it could be a state.
Yeah.
It could be a particular legislative body.
Mm.
It could be the Supreme Court.
it's an interesting thing,
it could be
right,
a whole party.
Because we're saying that microaggressions, still, like, they're, some people might say that they're the majority of the problem now, but black people, African Americans, are still being shot in broad daylight in the street in America.
And then having to try and justify if they were murdered.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So it's like, it's almost like now we have both, you know, we have this microaggressions or just the aggressions, like that mailroom incident. It's just aggressive and completely racist and unnecessary. But there's obviously more subtle things, but then it's almost like we have now both extremes of violence.
I think it's hard.
Yeah.
Interracial violence from police officers and people of authority in general on black and Hispanic Americans and now Chinese Americans, I mean, not now, but like
more
recently highlighted, are very problematic. It's a huge, massive issue. I think that there is probably quite a spectrum of police officers, though. Like, I think it's complicated in that I think that there are a lot of police officers who want to do the right thing, but maybe don't have the knowledge and the training on how to do the right thing, and that doesn't absolve them. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, like, I think there has been a lot of progress moving forward. I think that microaggressions are, like, the thing is that they're not different. I don't think there are as many overtly racist police officers who are gunning down black people because they actively think black people are more dangerous.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I'm saying the microaggressions are resulting in the thinking that is resulting in black people being gunned down by police officers.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes it harder.
Yeah.
So it feels more overwhelming because it feels harder to tackle.
Yes.
Psychology.
Yes.
Because that's what it is. It is years and years of brainwashing.
Totally.
And I don't even think we know how to fix that, because I don't think it is enough to just do training. There are studies that show that sensitivity training and stuff only works for a certain amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
And
we were literally talking about this at work the other day.
Like, there's so much training that would need to be done, and it would need to be done for generations consistently to even begin to undo that harm, because people are still being raised today with problematic views on black people in America, with problematic depictions, with stereotypes, with white savior narratives.
Yeah.
Being a significant part of the history that they're being taught. This book is definitely taught in America. I would say the book is not taught as often as the film is. The film is probably taught more. The Help is taught. To Kill a Mockingbird is taught. The film is taught. Like, the book is, like, you know, we're not getting to the heart of the problem.
I agree.
And
I would say systemic change is what is needed for so many issues in society. Like, it's... We're just scratching the surface, and
that's why I gave the film a 5, because it's still part of the problem.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
I'm sorry I cut you off.
No,
I made that realization.
I totally agree with you. My colleague and I were talking about this literally on Thursday, how we did this Beyond Diversity workshop, which was a really good, intense, draining 2-day workshop talking about racism specifically in New Zealand. And we were talking about how much of that knowledge and push to go forward and to make the world better as white people, how much of that motivation we'd lost, because it is so exhausting to be in that mind frame. Like, for a week afterwards, we were just so shattered. And now, it's like your brain absorbs it, and then it forgets it and moves on because you just can't process it, you know? And it's like, you do all these...
It's because we get to do that, but black people don't.
I know, exactly right. And it's like, but what you're saying to help fix it, like, what it would need to be is something so regular and so scheduled, it became a part of our lives, daily, weekly, monthly, whatever, to be challenging our views and to bettering ourselves and to be, like, introspective to look at our behaviors. But it has to be, like this is something that people don't understand about change. Like, humans are amazing, but also fucking morons. Like, we have things like New Year's resolutions, right? And it's like, because it's a new year, I'm going to be a different person. That's not how we work. Like, you and I have been together for 7 years, and we go through periods of growth and periods of stagnation, because that's what humans do.
I'm just building on your idea, and I want to add to this, because I feel like I'm not saying that we need constant of those conventions, because that would be shattering. We couldn't do that all the time, and we shouldn't do that all the time. It's just like a diet. A diet doesn't work because you're trying to make
A diet doesn't work
because you're trying to make a huge shift over time. You have to set up new habits.
But so no, it's no, not, I'm saying the smaller things Yes, more frequently.
It doesn't need to be like making yourself feel like a shit human being.
Yeah.
It's just like going, huh, a little bit more often in issues of race.
Yes, totally.
Like daily. Yeah. It's, you know, in New Zealand, it's making the, you know, a baby step that a lot of New Zealanders can make. A lot of New Zealanders is making the, you know, and I'm doing it now. I should be saying Aotearoa New Zealand.
Yes.
You know, Otatahi Christchurch. It's and then pronouncing the words correctly.
Yes.
Those are baby steps that every New Zealander can make.
Well, that's
to be a
why
little
I started
racist.
The podcast.
Yeah.
With, and it wasn't a full mihi, but
you could just call it a greeting.
It yeah, exactly. And but I want to do that because it's like, I have been to ceremony after ceremony in my life growing up in Aotearoa, and I've not understood the first 10 to 15 minutes of all of them because they're in Te Reo Māori. And I both blame the school system for not having it as a compulsory subject, but I also blame myself. I should know more Te Reo than I do. And it's absolutely on me that I don't know that. And so what I do know, I should be using it way more frequently, because we all know that languages, if you don't use them, you lose them. Like you and I were just talking about how we both speak fluent English, but we misunderstand each other constantly because we're the meaning of what we're saying is different.
Mm.
Let alone learning a second language together.
Mm. Snaps. Yeah. So I'm.
Yes.
So we're. So yeah, I'm going.
So that's it. This is our plan. This is our plan to fix society. Yes. Here it is.
We solved it.
We solved it.
Two white lesbians sitting at a table, one half glass of wine in. We fixed it. No, we didn't.
Yeah, yes.
The point is that I'm completely justified in giving the film a 5.
You are. 100%.
But also I'm not, because we need more films representing black people and Octavia Spencer and Taraji P. Henson and Janelle Monáe are incredible, incredible, incredible people, and they deserve more roles. They deserve better roles. These were good. These were great roles. They deserve more.
They do.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah,
that's it.
It's really important that we make films like these, even though they're not perfect, honey. Is because when you have three black female leads, not only is it telling the story that it's telling, but it's also showing more than one type of the character that we think of. Like, there's all these tropes about, like, yes,
no,
you know, there's like the angry black woman and all these things, and I just think that it's really good that people like this movie, you get to see three different black women.
Hmm.
To try and reinforce in white people's brains that they're not a homogenous group.
Yes. Yes.
Because white people always see themselves as individuals.
I'm going to slightly switch keys and argue your perspective.
Argue it.
Yes. Because I love this book, and I think that it definitely broke a glass ceiling in terms of the untold history of black women.
Yes.
But I'm sure there are lots of stories like this that we don't know, and I haven't heard about their books yet.
Totally agree.
So maybe the ceiling needs to be broken a little bit more. But I still say they broke it, but maybe they only broke like a corner.
Well, this
is. I don't know if they shattered.
This is the thing, isn't it? Like. Because now that you're aware of this book and you've read it, you may be going looking for other things like it or for stories that have not been a part of mainstream. But you have to actively search that out.
I'm always looking for them. But this podcast takes up a lot of my reading time.
I know, but that's why it's good that we get to choose what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Well, you know my revamp, remake, retire. Because I've said it like 10 times.
You have. Shit. I don't know.
I'd like to draw attention to this little quote from Elle. It says stellar. Elle. Elle magazine said this is stellar, and I just think it's real funny because stellar is like a space word.
Maybe that's why they put it there. I don't know if I want to retire it or to revamp it.
Revamp it.
I just.
What's your justification? Tell me about the.
For retirement.
Yeah.
Just because it's like. People should read the book. But with the movie, I guess I want the movie to draw attention to the book so that people can read the book and be better educated. But I also, there were so many narratives.
But there are so many people who aren't going to read this book. They're just never going to pick up a book like this.
I know.
Just because they're black. It's because it has a lot of pages and very few pictures.
I know. But there's so many narratives that haven't been told of other marginalized groups. And I'm like, fuck. You know?
I would argue their narrative hasn't really been told yet.
Yep. And I think you're correct.
On the screen.
So that's why I can't, you know, even though I feel more pulled to retire, revamp is obviously maybe even more how I feel.
Well, I think, honey, that you're probably putting a little bit too much stock in your decision because we have no effect on whether it's to be made. No one's listening.
No, people are listening.
Yeah, not no one, but, like, no one. Nobody, none of our listeners are no one, but I'm just saying, like, nobody in Hollywood. Except maybe my friend, Laura, who doesn't even live in Hollywood. Lives, like, adjacent to Hollywood.
Hollywood adjacent. Okay. Good. Are you good?
I'm good.
Are you all right?
I'm fine.
Yeah, we're all just getting by. Cool. We have the last episode of our season 2 up next. Is that correct?
I don't know.
Yeah, you do.
I know that we're planning on doing Whale Rider by Huiti Ihamade, but I don't know if we're also planning on doing Half a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know, Maddie.
I just thought we had Whale Rider left, but you're right. I guess we'll do Whale Rider and then we'll see.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening. We have a Patreon if you want to give us any money, but you don't have to. We'll keep doing this anyway. We hope that you're good. We hope that you're taking care of yourself. Feel free to email us, Facebook us, Instagram, Twitter. We're all over the place. Chapter 1, Take 2 is a podcast recorded by two lesbians living in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Aotearoa. Great. This was Hidden Figures by Margot Lee Shetley. Very well done. To you. Ka kite anō. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, Kona.
Oh, no. Yes.